Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk.
Second, as I was listening to the music playing, I was getting lots of reverberation and background echoes. So I am certainly concerned. That said, JB, congratulations on your new job, and Kirk, congratulations on being able to see you again.
Thanks.
A couple of items in the news before we press on. You may be aware that the Mythosonians, the Falsosonians, whichever you want to call them, those that are projecting themselves as Palestinians and want a country called Palestine, even though there is no such place and there are no such people, they have been given a sneak preview of the Trumpsters two-state solution. And because it doesn't give them all of Jerusalem, it doesn't give them the entirety, basically, of Israel, they're saying it's akin to their destruction and their demise. So Abbas has boycotted all political dealings with the Trump administration. And the deal that has been outlined so far has been dismissed by Abbas's as nothing more than the intent to destroy the Palestinian people. You know, that's pretty braggadocious for a guy that is head of a terrorist organization, the PLO, who has never won an election. Hamas always wins. Who has never honored an agreement. You know, they still teach in school the mass murder of Jews. Who promotes an absolute myth that there's a place called Palestine and a people called Palestinians, and they're somehow entitled to this, an academic fraud of gargantuan proportions. You know, if he would actually read the book that introduces us to the Philistines, from which they're named after, in Philistia, what he would find is that the God who told us about them says that they're invading terrorists, and that upon his return, he's going to wipe them out to the last. So they may really not want to make that claim, because it is it's a deadly game they're playing. I saw also in the news, and I'm stunned, that America not only elected a narcissist, but guess you have to consider who he ran against, but that there are some 45% of the American people that actually are committed to supporting a narcissist. But you hear what the Trumpster wanted done while he was touring and giving a speech on a naval base in Japan?
No, sir.
No. Oh, well. There's a one of the newest ships in the U.S. Navy has been named the USS Johnny McCain. And of course, the Trumpster doesn't like Johnny McCain, even though he's dead, and he holds a grudge. And so what he decided is that that the McCain had to put a tarp over its name. And that in addition to that, they had to put a barge in front of it. And that anyone wearing a uniform that that mentioned that they served on the USS McCain, they could not attend his speech. And those that tried were turned away. Can you imagine having the kind of ego that would say that a Navy ship named after a senator, John McCain, had to have a banner covering its name because you would find it somehow insulting? I guess there's some 60 psychiatrists that have diagnosed him as a narcissist. And it's obviously true. And that's scary for America. Did you hear who the Trumpster was going to pardon before he was released?
Uh-uh.
Yeah, there's a Naval Special Operations Chief, Edward Gallagher, 39 years old, been in jail. He's a sniper. One day he just went berserk. And rather than shooting at alleged bad guys, of course you can't tell the bad guys from the good guys, he just started indiscriminately killing. Killed, I think, 14 civilians, women and children. Just, you know, target practice. I'm just shooting away up here. But, you know, America's soldiers are fighting for our freedom. So, well, he was supposed to start trial next week on manslaughter charges. A military judge freed him because the prosecutors acknowledged that they were tracking the defense team's emails. On a technicality. Now, it's disgusting that the defense team wouldn't respect the other side's emails and showed the lack of ethics and was tracking them. And that is disgusting.
The government does that to everybody.
But prosecute them.
Yeah, you don't
keep the man in jail. You know, when you release someone who has murdered civilians, all you do is you make everything that you had invested in that war. Now, that was a war that was wholly counterproductive from the beginning. It made a bad situation worse. But any chance you had of even having the smallest gain is wiped out when you say it's okay that this guy murdered women and children just because he, you know, got trigger rich. Pretty disgusting. Oh, by the way, Trump was going to pardon him if he had been convicted. Was reading another article in the news, and it the U.S. wants to have its cake and eat it too. It wants to claim that the Islamic State has been eradicated, because then we can pound our chest and say, look what we did. You know, mission accomplished, the George Bush banner on the ship. But if the mission is accomplished and the Islamic State is gone, as the United States has bragged, then what are we doing over there? We just sent another 1,500 troops. So what they're saying is that the Caliphate has been defeated, but the Islamic State remains a threat. Of course, they never write out Islamic State. It's always is. But in this article that I read, The U.S. Military has now admitted that it killed 1,100 civilians in its attack on the Islamic State. Well, you might think that's, you know, okay, that's not so bad, but there's a couple of problems with the 1,100 number. I don't think there ever were 1,100 members of the Islamic State in Syria. They did a lot with very few people. And second, according to the most capable civil rights groups, the number is over 13,000, which is well more than there were members of the Islamic State. You know, when you do that, all you do is exacerbate the problem. It's like Vietnam. All the Viet Cong had to do is point to the airplanes dropping napalm and say, look at the insignia on those planes. Who's your enemy? Muslims are motivated to commit acts of jihad almost universally because they say, well, you deserve it because you have killed Muslim women and children. Even the attack in recently that was in India. Same exact, or Sri Lanka. Now, that was their excuse. Now, it's true that Muslims murder far more Muslims than non-Muslims kill Muslims. But you don't expect someone that is going to be a suicide bomber to be effective with evidence and reason. You just don't play into their hands. It's stupid. Last item in the news, speaking of stupid. Did you see the story out of Pakistan? There was a Pakistani vet that was charged with blasphemy because inadvertently, not reading Arabic and not knowing it, he wrapped some of the medicines that he was distributing in some books that had been tossed away, and the books were school textbooks on Islam, so that some of the medicine was given to customers wrapped in a religious text. So he was charged with blasphemy. And so do you know what the locals did in Pakistan?
Probably beat him to death.
Stoned him?
Yeah, screaming. And this was a Hindu veterinary doctor. They screaming Allahu Akbar and carrying sounds, death to all blasphemers, completely ransacked not only his office where he was, you know, serving the community, burned it to a ground, but then looted and burnt every Hindu office and home and storefront that they could find.
Oh. Of course, that's the rational way to deal with it.
Oh, of course. I mean, they're just savages. The fact of the matter is, Islam is the dumbest religion ever conceived, and it's the most deadly and destructive and corrosive. And so what you see happen in Pakistan is the consequence of the world not dealing with Islam and continuing, because of multiculturalism and political correctness, to accept it. It's a crying shame. That's just what it is. It's an absolute crying shame. There is some research that has been done recently. I don't know if you have been following it at all, but there's been quite the debate on did Sodom and Gomorrah actually exist, and if so, where were they located? And the thought for years has been, because it's very difficult to do research, archaeological research, in many of the areas where Muslims live. They don't like what archaeologists find, because every bit of research proves that their claims are completely bogus. And so it was assumed that two cities at the far southern end of the Dead Sea, which is much further south than I would have accepted them, because, well, quite frankly, and you read the story, Lot was brought out by the Malak and said, you know, the home is right up that mountain there. Let's go that way. And Lot said, no, I don't want to do that. So you'd have to put it essentially next to Jerusalem, not at the far end of the Dead Sea. The northern end of the Dead Sea is due east of Jerusalem. It's what you would see, as I've said, that I've looked out from Masada in that direction, and you see places that look like the ruins of ancient cities. Those cities are interesting in the south part of the Dead Sea, is that they were destroyed by a cataclysmic event out of the heavens, but it turned out it was an asteroid strike that destroyed those cities. But the five cities of the plain, and the plain is actually the Hebrew word for that's used for bowl. It's an inverted bowl. It's kind of like what flatbread looks like. And it's a well-watered area, which means that it has to be along the Yarden, the Jordan, which means it has to be north of the Dead Sea because there is no Jordan south of the Dead Sea. That's the only way for it to be a well-watered plain. And there is an area that is described, or that is geographically exactly as it's described, and exactly as you would expect, based upon the directions that that Abraham and Lot were going when Lot chose one way and Abraham chose the other, or took the other. And find out that there are five cities there, just as Yahweh had said. And it's come to find out they were all destroyed at the same time. And there's thousands of bodies buried there. And another interesting aspect of them, they were not only destroyed at the right time, according to the account, but on top of that, the pottery became so hot that it crystallized like glass. So there's absolute proof that Sodom and Gomorrah, they found both cities, as well as the other three that were destroyed. All destroyed at the same time, all destroyed in the same way, all catastrophic. So the story we're reading isn't just a lesson for us, and it is a lesson for us, but it's also archaeological, historical reality. Then Lot said unto them, "No, I beg you, my lords, look here, please. If your associate has found favor in your sight, so this being the case, you have shown great kindness, which you have acted out with me, such that my soul continues to live. But I am incapable of escaping by fleeing to the mount." And so the miserable attitude, the overt wrongdoing, and the twisted perversions, the ra'ah, they're going to cling to me, be associated with me, and I'm going to die. Well, that alone ought to tell us where he was. From where he was, you could see the mount. I don't know if you could see Moriah, but you could certainly see Olives, which is due east of it, and it would have been due west of where he was standing. And it's a hike. I've been there. But, you know, I've gone hiking in the Sierras, put on a pack that was close to 65 pounds with my sons. You know, when you go backpacking with your sons, you carry a lot of weight, 65, 70 pounds. And I've climbed from 6,000 feet up to 12,500 over the course of a two-day hike, and you know, carried all the gear and all the food and everything else, and you know, I'm at the time would have been of similar age to Lot. It was actually fun. It was a great outing. So this idea that Lot said, "No, I don't want to do it," spoke far more about his attitude than his ability. His attitude had become his disability. And it's really true for all of us. If we aren't willing to put in the effort, we aren't going to get the benefit. then Yahweh has made it such that you aren't going to know the truth unless you invest the time to learn the truth. You aren't going to be part of his family unless you're willing to study what he has to say, to listen to what he has to say, to think about what he has to say, and then act upon it. And Lot wasn't. Lot had essentially been given a free pass, you know, something that may happen quietly for most of us, where we're going about our lives and we get a tap on the shoulder that says, over here, listen to this. And it directs us to Yah once we have made a decision to begin to question religion and politics. And with Lot, though, it was far more right there in his face. He had two malak, visual malak, saying, we're going to tell you what's going to happen. We'll spend the evening with you, and you need to get out of town now because we've been tasked with the destruction of this place. And our only requirement prior to the destruction of this place is getting you out of town. And then, you know, they had no obligation to do so, but it would be their natural tendency. They knew Yahweh. They knew that exactly what was what. And they said, go up there. You want to go home? Go up there. That's only up there. It's not only where home is and permanent safety is there. Eternal safety is up there. But, you know, so is your uncle. It's where the covenant is. Go up there. What do you say? No. It's too difficult for me. I want you to cut me a special deal. He was playing the same role as the people in Sodom. No, cut me a special deal. You know, I've earned some kindness in your eyes. So, cut me a different deal. Don't require this of me. What do you think Yahweh's going to say if you show up and before him and you say, hey, Yah, you know, I was busy. I had stuff to do. And, you know, yeah, I heard about the fact that you and I might have had some lists and some requirements, but you got to cut me some slack here. You know, I couldn't be bothered with all of that.
Good luck.
What are you guys going to say? I said, maybe I shouldn't have been bothered with Pesach. It's too tough for you to do the little bit that I asked, and yet I suffered matzah for you? Wait a minute. Who's who here? I'm offering you an eternity with me, and all I ask in return is you do these five things, all of which are in your interest anyway. I just ask you to attend some parties. I'm throwing the parties. All you have to do is show up. And now you're telling me, no. Come on, cut me some slack. I was busy. It was too arduous.
It was too hard.
Yeah. What do you think the odds are that God's going to say, hey, no problem. Your way is just as good as my way.
Yeah, come on in. You don't know me. I don't know you. But, yeah, sure, come on in. Come live with me.
Come on in. I'll spend eternity with you. I'll trust you. Oh, wait a minute. How can I trust you? I don't even know you. As was the case with Lot, if we retain a connection to the twisted perversions of man, we're not welcome in heaven. We either walk away or die. The benefits of the covenant are not free. They're not given away willy-nilly without effort and active engagement by the recipient. This isn't welfare. Welfare is destructive. The covenant is beneficial. They are not entitlements. This is not a bankruptcy system. This is not a Ponzi scheme. It's not as the Christian New Testament claims, charis, a charity. The Roman goddesses of gratia, grace, do not hold sway. Even when Lot, enveloped and entwined, wrapped up and encased in the broad and open ways, gospel of grace, wanted it to be so. Yahweh is not going to carry us kicking and screaming into the promised land, nor is he going to carry the comatose or the apathetic. Just the way it is. You don't like it? Tough. Fact is, if you don't like it, good. You know, I have been finished translating some amazing passages in these last few days. You know, I had been humbled and shaken when we stumbled across Chodorinneck, that said an insignificant branch would somehow contribute to a sign that would properly convey Dode's invitation to return back home and present Dode's role in the life of Israel. And I'm not going to share it today. I don't know when I'm going to share it. But I will say this. I was translating the fifth Mizmor. And I came to realize in the fifth Mizmor, there was a line in the fifth Mizmor that made it clear that the second coming isn't of Yosha. It's Dode. And the terminology that was used caused me to say, I've heard that before. And so I went to Yahuchanan the Immerser's statement where he quoted from Yeshayah 40 about, you know, I'm the voice crying out in the wilderness, make way the way of the Lord, make level the way of the Lord. You've probably heard that 1,000 times, right? Probably the second or third most quoted Christian prophecy. It doesn't pertain to Yosha. As a matter of fact, Dode specifically announced that it pertained to him. How about them apples? And then as we're going through this, Yahweh is describing who is going to fulfill that prophecy. And it's Dode. And he, in explaining it, he refers to Dode by a name that I had ascribed, a title that I described to the sacrificial lamb. 10 years ago, I wrote a chapter called Zeruah, Sacrificial Lamb. And I looked because in the Torah, every time Zeruah is written, it's speaking of an aspect of the Passover lamb. But Zeruah is used a lot of times outside of the Torah. And come to find out, this prophecy specifically speaks of the Zeruah, and the Zeruah in this case is attributed to Dode, because it's more than just sacrificial lamb. It's an empowered shepherd. And I found out that there are actually three Zeruah, not one. It's just like Babylon's. There's three of them. There's geographic Babylon, religious Babylon, political Babylon. Geographic Babylon is where the 10 tribes that are considered lost were sent, and many of them remained. The percentage of Jewish DNA, haplogroup J1, and in the ethnic mix of some of the people, there's some it goes as high as 70-80%. But almost every meaningful leader in the Islamic world, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, royal family of both Syria and of Jordan, previously in Iraq, they're all Jews. And so there's a geographic Babylon that Yahweh is calling his people out of. There is a political Babylon, the United States of America. That's the one that's spoken of most adroitly in Revelation. And then there's religious Babylon, which is the one that Daniel speaks of, that emerged from Imperial Rome, that's the Roman Catholic Church. Well, likewise, there are three Zeruah. The first was Moshe. The passage that speaks specifically of Moshe being an empowered shepherd, and he was. And then there's several that describe Dod as an empowered shepherd, Zeruah. And then one that, or number that, that speak of the Zeruah in connection with the Passover lamb. Therefore, Yosha. There's three. Each of which play a important but different role in God's plan. And so as I was studying this, and I really wanted to get to the bottom of Zeruah, because I wasn't wrong, but I wasn't completely correct. It is sacrificial lamb, but it's much more than that. And come to find out, probably the second most cited passage, prophetic passage, Yeshaya 53, you know, the one rabbis will never read, because it's obviously that it's talking about the sacrificial lamb of Pesach. It begins by saying that there's going to be somebody that finally figures out who the Zeruah is. And then come to find out at the dedication of the temple, Solomon gives the speech of his life. It's his equivalent of the Sermon on the Mount. And he references it too. And he speaks of a Nakri. And so for those of you who like to translate, I would encourage you to translate Solomon's speech at the dedication of the temple. And the reason I share all of this at this moment is that we ought not be fooling around here. Yahweh specifically and multiple times talked about what we are doing and the importance of it. And it goes so far beyond the original thought of Choder and Neck. It's breathtaking. He's not fooling around. He is telling his people to listen and do. Listen and act. Listen and engage based upon what they read. So what we're doing is important. God predicted it 3,000 years ago. And so we ought not ever take the approach that Lot took. Ah, it's too tough for me. Listen, I'm going to tell you, when I read this, I was not happy. In fact, I haven't been so disappointed in something in a very long time. Because up to this point, I've done this as a labor of love. I do it because I can't think of anything more fun to do. And all my hobbies I essentially gave up because this is a lot more fun. It's a lot more rewarding. But based upon what Solomon has to say and what is said in Yeshaya, while it is fun, while it is rewarding, this is serious. We're playing an extraordinarily important role in the single most important mission that Yah has for the end times. And that mission is twofold. Warn the world that they're going in the wrong direction and invite them home. Tell them about Yahweh and what they need to do if they want to engage in a relationship with Him, particularly Israel. So, folks, it's always been the same. The first step toward the covenant is to walk away from our country, from the babble of religion and politics, from the fractured nature of the human family, and from societal conditioning. And yet, Lot couldn't even get that right. Preferred to linger and then complain. And then when given the opportunity to break free, no, it's too much for me. Moriah would have required a considerable change in elevation. But it was in sight and in reach, and he chose not to go. And look what happened to him. He became a drunken, cave-dwelling man who committed incest. At times like these, I often wonder how much of what we're reading was conveyed for our benefit and not necessarily understood by those among whom it was attributed. Lot never seemed to understand what was occurring around him, and yet his words surmise what was at stake with astounding clarity. You know, for example, Lot did not mention Pesach or even the seven Mikre, and he made no association between matzah that he prepared and served and the Mikra of matzah, nor made any connection from these things to the seven doors. And it was all there for us to dine on, all of it. So how is it possible, we may wonder, for Lot to begin with the sublime and when he was largely unaware of it, and then become a boorish babbler who in so doing illuminates the path all the more? And I think the answer, and we talked about this briefly about a month ago, lies in a momentary suppression, but not suspension of free will. Yahweh's Malach enabled Lot to say things which were stunningly revealing, and then, when they stopped inspiring him, he became himself, providing us with insights from yet another perspective, that of man's way. Based on all I've observed, this does not occur very often, but often enough to fill the Torah, the Mizmor, Wanabi, with guidance to last a lifetime. And frankly, there's only an upside here, because it matters not that Lot may have been inspired and then uninspired. It was the case with Dod. With the exception of the two Malach, those he spoke to were never going to listen, and they're long gone. But the fact is, we aren't, and we're listening. And so it's beneficial to us and for all of those willing to listen to what we have to say, to what we found. What do you guys think? Is it possible that free will can be suppressed but not suspended, such that we have these stories?
Sure.
I can see that.
Well, would it
I'd be happy to have it done to me. I need just, you know, it's you're effectively being a tool, but you're being a tool for the on the right team for the right reasons, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
He's allowed. He's done that quite a few times. Not a mm-hmm. lot of times. There are many times when he's done that. And, through someone.
I can't see it happening unless there's someone Yahweh or many people Yahweh wants to have access to the information that is being conveyed. So, you know, if we're just having a conversation, I just don't think it's a prayer. But if that conversation is going to be recorded in the Torah, absolutely. All upside, no downside.
Yeah, it's all teaching instrument.
Right. Exactly. Beyond this, Lot, to a significant degree, represents Israel, just as we shall learn that Sodom represents Moab, and Moab, man's world today. At times, Yisrael was inspired by the creator of the universe and the author of life, and at others, they were dumb as stones and equally hard-headed. Yisrael has long been Lot, entangled in the ways of the Gentiles. One of the things about the Sholomo speech, this is why it is so gripping, so humbling. What does Yahweh say about the ways of the Gentiles? He's pretty consistent. What does he have to say?
They're going the wrong way. They're dysfunctional.
Yeah, don't listen to them. Don't follow that way. Don't listen to them. Don't do it. You know, it's kind of like Chawa's impression of the apple. Don't look at it. Don't touch it. Don't eat it. Don't do nothing to it. Right? Basically what he says in terms of the ways of the Gentiles?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so Solomon says there's going to come along a Nakri. He's going to come from a place a great, great distance away from Israel and a great time removed from the time of making his speech. And he's a foreigner. Nakri means foreigner. He, in fact, even says, and not of Israel.
Wow.
So he is now somebody who is clearly Goyim. He is foreigner from a place a great distance away at a time a great distance away. And what he said is, listen to what he says and engage doing all that he writes. Speaking to Israel. So, since Israel's constant, or Yahweh's constant teaching to Israel is, don't listen to those guys. They get you in trouble. When you read the lone exception, it causes you to gulp. Causes you to take a big gulp.
Gulping.
Yep. So Lot, like Israel, is long entangled in the way of the Gentiles. The man whose oration had been so insightful in Sodom was anything but on his way out of town. He was not only being a lazy whiner, he was actually like he thought he could negotiate his own plan of salvation with Yahweh's representatives. I'm telling you, folks, you can't do that. Behold, look up now. Please agree that this nearby city in close proximity, right over there, is acceptable to flee. It's Mitzar. It's lowly and little. It's diminutive and unpretentious. It's no big deal. I want to be saved by that name in that place. I pray and plead.
You want to be saved on my terms.
Yeah. Absolutely. Isn't it a small thing? Because it's my soul's desire to live. Baruch 19:20. It's just a little alteration. Surely God's not going to have a conniption fit that I made this little small change. I wanted to go to the place that and be saved by the name of lowly and little. Oh. So who's lowly and little? Welcome to the land of Pauline doctrine. Paulos means lowly and little in Latin. He wanted to be saved by the way of Christianity. Gospel of grace. I just have to believe and I'll be saved. Salvation is a free gift. I just want to go over there. I'll do it my way. Behold, please,
sure,
that nearby city, it's close by, right over there. It's acceptable. It's lowly and little. I want to be saved by that name in that place. How'd it work out for him?
It didn't.
No. Here Abraham has the blessings of eternity. Direct relationship with the creator of the universe. Enriched in every possible and imaginable way. And Lot, by comparison, says, no, I want to do it my way. And didn't turn out so well for him. He would end up in a cave. A broken, drunken old man. having sex with his daughters. Wow.
Wow, indeed.
So if you want to learn a lesson from this story, that's the lesson. Yah's not going to accept your way. You know, you go to somebody that says, you know, I live a pretty good life. I think I'll be okay with the Almighty. Good for you. No, you aren't. He's established a way. He's communicated his way. He's made his way available. He's made his name available. You don't even know his name. Boy, one thing that Dodd makes abundantly clear, as does Solomon in his speech, it all starts with Yahweh's name. If you don't know Yahweh's name, you don't know him. If you don't use Yahweh's name, you aren't speaking for him. But this is the story. No, you have to be able not just to physically walk away. He was physically walking away from Sodom, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
But he longed for it. He couldn't let it go, which tells you it's not the geographic distance. It's your attitude. You know, I live right now in South Florida. Last time I checked, it's part of the United States. So have I walked away from my country in the geographic sense? No. But I don't fly American flags. I don't vote. I don't support the troops. I don't engage in politics. So that's what is being conveyed, is that Lot was unwilling to do that. He was unwilling to put in the effort, and he wanted to do it his way. Unacceptable. We'll see what happens to him. What he's proposing is the essence of religion. Why are you making such a big deal? The difference between us, between the New and Old Testaments, between the Torah and the Talmud, between the Bible and the Quran. Come on, we all worship the same God. Let's celebrate the commonality and ignore the differences. I mean, what's the difference really between Yahweh and Allah, between Yahusha and Jesus, between Dodd and Shaul? Why must it always be God's way? Aren't my ways, man's ways, also worthy? Don't all religions lead to God?
No.
That is what's being brought before us here. No. Yeah, you know, what's going to happen here is the Malak are going to let him do what he wants to do, free will and all. It's going to turn out really badly for him. In certain arenas, man's ways are valid, but not when they conflict with Yahweh's guidance. Once Paul, which means mitzar, lowly and little, began promoting his way in opposition to God's way, he damned his soul and all who believed him. In this way, Lot is exposing and damning Christianity, a religion which promises to save souls from the fire and brimstone based upon the will of those seeking salvation. Mind you, they know nothing about what they are seeking to be delivered to, only what they want to be saved from. They have no compunction whatsoever to listen to God first, to consider what he's offering or requesting. No, they want to babble to him. They want to tell God, what do they want? I want to be saved over there, that way. Their entire focus is on themselves, their beliefs, their opinions, their desires, their lives. Come on, God, it's just a small favor. Save me. But it's not. The Lamb of God was sacrificed for Pesach, and his soul suffered to facilitate matzah, both of which compromise Yah's favor, neither of which are replaceable. Now, the Malak and the Malak had no authority to grant any favors, and they didn't do Lot a favor. Going from one city to another extended his mortal life marginally. But without going to Mount Moriah, his soul would be destroyed as surely as were those in Sodom. But what the Malak could do was to allow Lot to choose so long as his choice did not interfere with the promise that Yahweh had made to Abraham to remove his nephew before destroying the city. By the way, something was found that's really interesting in the city that appears to be ancient Sodom, along the Jordan River, due north of the Dead Sea, due east of Jerusalem. The first ever recorded case of syphilis. Do you know how syphilis is was originally contracted?
No.
Bestiality. Yep. Making love to sheepies. Yep, you know the two institutions that were the most prone to pass it around the world once it was derived from having sex with sheep?
Well, the British Navy certainly helped.
Yeah, militaries and religious institutions. They were the two that conveyed it around the world. The Roman Catholic Church was spectacular at it, by the way.
All through Europe, yeah.
It's always good to be good at something, right?
Yeah.
They said to him, he said to him, pay attention. I will lift up and respect your presence and also support this statement from the word, because I was not going to overthrow this city of which you have spoken. So here's one of the Moloch saying, yeah, said to him, pay attention. I will lift up and respect your presence. What does that mean? My job was to get you out of Dodge. I've got some cities I'm going to destroy. I had to get you out of Sodom, which was the first one I'm going to destroy. Your presence here, I want to respect that fact. So since you're here, whatever you want to do is up to you. This is my job, and I've got half of my job's now done. I got you out of town. And I'm not going to overthrow the city of which you have spoken. By the way, he didn't even say the name, did he? The wording here is very, very clever, and in a good way. It's so exacting, one has to appreciate the author's marvelously effective communication skill. The Malachim were sent to do two things, and true to the word, they were completing both tasks, removing Lot and then destroying Sodom. Beyond this, Lot was free to choose whatever direction he wanted to go in life, just as it had been when Uncle Abram initially gave him a similar choice. You know, you can go this way and I'll go that. You choose. Since the Malachim were not authorized to overthrow Zor, Lot could scamper over that away and avoid the rigors of ascending Moriah. Now, the Malach's next statement is especially telling. This will be 1922. Of your own free will, impetuously, even fearfully, rashly, hurriedly, devoid of wisdom or sense, scurry off and ignorantly flee there if you prefer that place and that name, because I am incapable of acting or engaging regarding the word until you arrive there. Therefore, it's appropriate that the name of the town was called Zor. Trivial and immature, lowly and little. Now, what do you think that God might have had some role in the naming of that place?
Absolutely.
Now, this occurred, by the way, 2,000 years before, 2,000 years before the lowly and little would become the adversary of the Torah in Yosha's Sermon on the Mount. Yep, the name of the place is, read it and weep, lowly and little, Zor. So he went to Paul, to the one called Zor, lowly and little. Are you seeing a pattern develop here? And lest I forget, the antonym of Zor is Bakor, firstborn. As such, the souls descended from Lot through Moab would be stillborn. This is hardly the story of a rapture. It's more akin to a twisted wake. But then again, Lot's preference for Soar over Sion was Mahar, impetuous and ignorant, or in a word, stupid. So is believing any religion. He was re-entering the dark and gloomy world of man. Bar Rashid in 1924. Remember, he left in the morning? Now, the sun's rays had left the region. Winlot arrived at Shur, lowly and little. Then Yahweh rained down upon Sodom and upon Amorah. Amorah means authoritarian manipulation, oppressive and tyrannical binding and twisting. It's from Amar, meaning to bind, to manipulate, to subjugate, with autocratic control, with lords treating the masses as serfs, servants, and slaves. Do you think there's any places in the world today where there's authoritarian manipulation, where people are subjugated to autocratic control?
It's about everywhere.
Well, certainly the entire Islamic Middle East, right?
Yeah.
In the Islamic Middle East, there isn't a single government that's not an authoritarian tyrant. Not one. You've got a couple outside of course, the Islamic Middle East. You've got Fat Bad Hair Boy in North Korea. Rumor is that he just executed his chief negotiator. But you've got him. In terms of just really authoritarian, you know, the Chinese government's pretty authoritarian. They have free enterprise in terms of economics, but you cross those boys and there is no reprieve. In fact, the current leader Xi is a lifetime dictator. So, but look at the Roman Catholic Church. Authoritarian manipulation.
Sure.
Brimstone and fire shall come out of the sky at the behest of Yahweh. So that was the contrast. He's the sun's rays had left the region, and Lot arrived at Zor, lowly and little. And then Yahweh rained down on Sodom and on Amorah, brimstone and fire. Came out of the sky, behest of Yahweh. I've actually seen one of the brimstone hailstones and had the opportunity to burn it. It burns with this brilliant, hot blue light. It's amazing to see a brimstone hailstone. And they're all over in that region. I mean, this really happened. And if you look at any one of those five cities that were destroyed, they're all destroyed at the same time, all in the same way. Thousands and thousands of bodies buried there. So this it happened exactly as Yahweh said. At this introduction of Amorah, it's the first time now it has been mentioned here in this story. Let's ponder the insights its name alone provides into the reasons Yahweh torched it along with Sodom. Amorah reveals that the city was plagued by a mix of authoritarian manipulation, tyrannical twisting, and oppressive binding, which is to say that it's indicative of the long and horrid legacy of imperial and Catholic Rome, political and religious Rome, but of course, of all of the Islamic realms as well. As the younger of the two cities, it's appropriate to associate Amorah with Lot's youngest son, Ben-Ammi. Child of my nation or descendant of my people, thereby making a connection between Ammon and Rome. Likewise, Lot's eldest son, Moab, being equated to Sodom, we can safely project its irrational and immoral perversions on its legacy today. And by the way, I'm not extrapolating here. I'm not just saying, well, that's the younger city, older city, firstborn, secondborn. Yahweh makes this point. He confirms that that he set it up this way, and that conclusion is valid. Now, it's interesting that sulfur is yellow, the color of the sun, and thus the pigment used to create countless religious relics like halos, for example. It is also symbolic of those without the courage to stand up for what's right. And yet it burns blue. That's the only color of light capable of freeing an electron. Lot and his family were freed from Sodom as a gift to Abraham. But considering the nature of the fractured human family, I'm sure the realization that our families cannot always be saved wasn't lost on the Father of the Covenant. He knew that Yahweh spared his nephew. But he would have also known that his fractured family was such that God couldn't save him. He just spared him from the conflagration that besieged that city. Extended his mortal life a few years. You know, one of the things, we had a show about 2 months ago where I talked about some of the challenges that I'd had family-wise, and it had been a real eye-opener to me because it helped me understand that Yahweh was telling us to walk away from the human family because the human family is really broken. And then I was started translating the first half a dozen psalms, and the guy that Yahweh loved most, the guy that Yahweh revealed more through than anyone else, the guy that Yahweh acknowledged is Mashiach, which is transliterated Messiah. The one he called, this is my son, the one he called beloved, the one that was his king and will be his king. Dode. Boy, did he have a fractured family. If his family was fractured, why wouldn't we expect that we would also have similar troubles? You know, we talked briefly about it, but his daughter was raped by his firstborn son. His thirdborn son then killed his firstborn. His thirdborn then revolted against him and started a civil war, only to be killed by his chief commander. And that's just the beginning of it. You know, in fact, Yahweh's relationship with Dode ended in terms of revelation and of them talking for a while, when Dode had a covenant member killed so that he could have his wife. So fractured families are the norm. It happened to Dode, which was the closest family ever with God. I mean, one of Dode's sons, Solomon, was designated by Yahweh to be the king of Israel. So it gives us a lot of insight into what we ought to expect. That's why Yosha, said, I didn't came to bring peace. The fact is that, there's going to be strife between father and son, between father and daughter, between mother and daughter, between, families. And there is. Very few of us have the benefit. I mean, I can probably count two or three where the majority of their family, parents, spouses, children, have accepted the covenant. I'm lucky and I have one of my two sons. But that's it. But that's enough. I'm thrilled with that. But that is our reality, is that for the most part, some like Kirk, and JB, you're among the exceptions. Your wives are our covenant. Yeah. It's one of the great blessings. And so he overturned and destroyed those cities and everyone in the, guess where, broad and open way. Kikar. In the broad and open way. anyone or anything connected with that, which is expansive and thus popular and inclusive, along with anything approximating the vicinity of the global community or circus. That which is related to round discs and loaves of bread and religious cakes, circuitous reasoning, and that which circumvents the issue. Kikar is the geographic description of where the cities were when, you know, Abraham and Lot were deciding who would go where, and Kikar describes that which is round. So you know, they looked from Ai, they were that the area they were in, and Bethel, I think, was the other city that was near where they were standing at the time, and they looked down over the area north of the Dead Sea, which would be where the Jordan River flows into it, the Arden, and there's one spot where it widens out, and it's there's a circular elevated area that the Jordan River passes right through. And guess where all five of those cities are?
Right there.
Within that circle.
Right.
Wow.
But that particular term means broad and open. Broad and open way, which is expansive, but it's a broad and open way that is based upon the concepts of circle and circular. You know, the Christian name church is based upon circular.
Mm-hmm.
Paul used circular reasoning. This was a tremendous insight for those willing to capitalize on it. So he overturned and destroyed those cities and everyone in the broad and open way, along with the inhabitants of the cities, including what sprouted and grew from that dirt. Wiped out everything. And it wasn't just the cities, but everyone in the broad and open way. Now, Yahweh has told us that he is going to return and deal with Moab, which is modern Sodom, just as he did with ancient Sodom. And if he said with ancient Sodom, it wasn't just that city, but all the related cities and everyone that was part of the broad and open way, everyone that's part of that which is popular and openly accepted. What is the natural, the only reasonable interpretation of that upon his return?
And do the same thing.
Yeah.
Sprouted and busted so, stuff on the ground.
Exactly.
Wow.
I'm going to wipe it all out.
Yes.
God has to not only wipe out religion, the doctrines, the edifices, the artifacts, all of the dead gods on a stick. He has to wipe out its host, which is those that believe it. Yahweh defined the broad and open way in his first and largest public address. Yosha did that. He not only revealed that this popular and inclusive way was contrary to the Torah, but that it was the path to death and destruction of the souls of those in opposition to it. Those beguiled by the wolf in sheep's clothing, who would be called lowly and little, which of course is Paulos in Latin, the Roman name Shaul, questioned him, chose to take for himself. The broad and open way, the popular and inclusive way, the way of circular reasoning, the way of church, which is based upon church, the daughter of Helios in the Germanic religion. The way associated with solar imagery is Christianity. God destroyed all traces of it on this day and will do the same during the last day. As God presents more and more information on Moab and compares Moab to Sodom, it becomes absolutely obvious that Moab is Pauline Christianity. But not just Pauline Christianity, as we will describe. Pauline Christianity today exists in a culture of multiculturalism and political correctness. And it's the combination of those things. Now, that nameless wife, interesting, she's never named. would be the first to go. It was really a lot of women that are named in the Torah. I think there's seven women that are actually prophets in the Torah. There's some that play exceedingly courageous and important roles. There's one who got her likeness included in Yahweh's name, Sarah. But this one, Lot's wife, nah, not so much. The nameless wife would be the first to go. It was proof that just because someone benefits by being in the company of someone who is associated with a member of the covenant, as was the case with Lot, or just because someone has an opportunity to listen to someone who conveyed Yahweh's message, as was the case with the wife, life in the covenant is far from assured. If and until a person relinquishes their affinity for Babel, for religion, for politics, for patriotism, for conspiracy, for political correctness, for multiculturalism, for societal mores and twisted family values, they remain separated from God, incapable of being saved, and excluded from the covenant. One of the lessons, if you really look closely and think about it, of Lot's wife being the first to go, mm-hmm. is that her claim would have been, wait a minute, I am associated through my husband with Abraham. Well, isn't that what Christianity claims? Isn't that what Islam claims? Isn't that what Judaism claims?
Mm-hmm. All of them.
Mm-hmm. How did it work out for Lot's wife?
That will.
Pillar of salt.
Well, yeah, a little salty, huh? A little salty.
You know, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Or add something
uh-huh.
there? That I looked up salt. It always has bothered me they turned into salt because mm-hmm. I always assumed it was an asteroid or some volcano or something of that nature that would have destroyed
mm-hmm.
it like that. Or they had to spew something up. So just interesting, just for fun, I looked up salt, and it really is a dissolvable powder.
Yes.
To tear away, to dissipate, to dispense into fragments. And as you were talking earlier, I was thinking about, well, in that kind of heat, you just kind of dissolve. I mean, you just totally dissipate because you're mostly water anyway. And then if it turns into crystals like glass, you know, it's breaking into fragments would make a lot of sense too. So it's all the words allow it.
Yes. Yeah, there's salt. We'll talk about this in a minute. There's
a lot of views on it. I mean, I'm saying with the salt
on
it.
Right.
Salt
loss. So what it says here is 1926. It says, so then Lot's wife longed for that which was behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. You know, all your Christian bibles, she just looked over her shoulder. Right. She wanted a quick peek at the fireworks show, and so, boy, that ruthless and mean God of the Old Testament, man, he just zapped her, turned her into salt. Yeah, boy, he's no fun. That's not the point. She longed for her life in Sodom. She didn't want to give it up. She didn't want to leave the place. She longed for where she had been, which is one of the most rotten and corrupt places on earth. That's why she was turned to a pillar of salt. Pillar is an outpost and column from Natsab to take one's stand and remain stationary and fixed. In other words, you're not willing to go, of salt, preserved in a condition which is torn away and dissipates. In Hebrew, to look can be written, as we know, shamar, which is to observe, ra'ah, which is to see, ein, which is to use one eyes. Lots of Hebrew words to describe look. Nabat, by contrast, speaks of longing for something and showing regard and respect for it. It is to look back with fondness, with a sense of affinity, a desire, and an ongoing attraction. The word rendered pillar, Natsib, explains the shape of the intended metaphor, because it can mean to take a stand, to be set in one's ways, to be determined to the point of being militaristic, stationary, and fixed in place. Now, Kirk, I'm like you. I can't tell you why she was turned to salt, other than to reflect on
Malak's
secondary view.
It was just, you know, but even if it was, it's salty, some kind of chemical. But interesting, you know, as you're talking about the Saab, I mean, Nasab, she's facing, if she represents the person needed, was needed, settled in her leash, if you want, wish, she's sitting down looking at the continuation or the nun, and not looking in the direction of Yah lifting up and putting her in his home.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Yeah.
Every way you look at it, yeah.
So yeah, she's looking in the wrong direction.
Point, you know, it's not a stretch at all. I mean, your point being, she longed for Sodom.
Yep.
And
it's interesting, of course, that these cities were all just north of the Dead Sea. What made the Dead Sea dead is that there was no way for the Jordan River's water to flow out. So the sun would cause the water to evaporate. And when the water was constantly evaporated, it would leave a higher and higher concentration of salt. And so it rose to the point, the salt rose to the point that it choked out all life. That's a pretty good indication as why it was salt. Moreover, the sea, representing both Gentiles on the likes of Sodom, which was located, you know, just north, really, along the shores of the Dead Sea, is differentiated from all other forms of water by its salt content. The more we drink of it, actually, the thirstier we become. You know, that's what's interesting. You need water to live, but the more seawater you drink, the thirstier you become. Too much salt water, and you will hallucinate and die. Further, when the earth is salted, nothing grows. You know, Romans salted Israel, Yehuda. Hadrian ordered it. Here are some other interesting thoughts about salt. It's a white cubic crystal. It becomes transparent when dissolved in water. And yet it is hydroscopic in that it has a propensity to absorb moisture around it. Further, when an electric current is passed through a saline solution, chlorine, sodium hydroxide, and hydrogen are formed, with the hydrogen and chlorine gases creating a highly explosive and extremely toxic mixture. And sodium hydroxide and chlorine, when combined, make bleach, one of nature's most deadly chemicals. They can also be combined to make sodium chloride, which is a herbicide. Also, when chlorine gas is burned in hydrogen, the two gases react to form hydrogen chloride, which then, when dissolved in water, forms hydrochloric acid, an extraordinarily corrosive liquid. Salt is valued by men because it preserves and seasons food and stimulates appetite. So much so, you probably know this, Kurt, salt was once the world's most popular currency.
Especially the Romans used it. Maybe.
Yeah, in some ways she was turned into money.
Yeah. It was appropriate.
Yeah. That's just some thoughts as to why it was salt. I don't claim to have the answer, but it's fun to muse.
Yeah. Really.
Abraham, enriching and merciful father, went back to the place early in the morning where he had stood in the presence of the name and renown of Yahweh. He looked down upon the appearance of Sodom scorched and upon Amorah, authoritarian manipulation, and upon all that appeared of the realm of the broad and open way. And as he looked, he beheld clouds of dense smoke ascending from the region like the smoke out of a crucible. Yeah, the crucible. That's the name, of course, for Mitzrayim, Egypt. Long before the children of Israel would spend 400 years there enslaved, became the crucible of human oppression, of religion and politics, of human schemes. So Abraham saw that God did exactly what he said, so it had to be bittersweet, I think, for Abraham. Abraham at this point. On one hand, he was witnessing the sudden death of many thousands of people and the obliteration of their culture. He had come to know Yahweh personally and now had firsthand evidence regarding just how much his God recognized the catastrophic and contagious nature of such perverse thinking and therefore hated the institutionalized morality manifest in these places. He would have seen it from his father's perspective, knowing that God was at peace over his response because it was the correct and caring thing to do for his family and for their home. But more than this, Abraham would have seen this as affirmation that Yahweh keeps his promises. And if he knew it, so should we. The crucible metaphor is one of Yah's favorites. And by the way, you know, in that there are five cities, and they are exactly where Yahweh described them. And they were all destroyed at the same time, in the same way, just as this story foretells. Which means that there was divine intervention, because guess what? Hail and brimstone. Brimstone, hail. Fire doesn't come out of the sky on a regular basis to wipe out places like this. And yet that's how they were all destroyed. What that means, if you're reasonable and rational, is the God who's telling this story actually exists, and he does what he says he's going to do. And that being the case, you'd have to be stupid not to listen to what he had to say. Truthfully, think about it.
Mm-hmm.
The affirmation that this happened, the affirmation, you know, when we went through the story of the flood, that the region that God describes was indeed flooded in exactly the way that God explains at exactly that time. You know, the 6 days of creation, when you look at the microwave radiation, cosmic radiation from the Big Bang, Yah's term, and you recognize the amount of energy there and how it has dissipated in that radiation and stretched, the time was stretched 10 to the 12th power. You just do the math. Take the 14 to 15 billion years. Divide it by 10 to the 12th. You get 6 24-hour days. I mean, what is it going to take for someone paying attention to say, the creator of the universe inspired these words? It's probably in my best interest to listen to what he had to say. And it's probably in our best interest to share it.
Absolutely.
Well, the crucible metaphor is one of God's favorites. It's deployed to depict the searing and scalding effect of being burned within the furnace of human, religious, political, military, economic, and societal influences. Almost everything inside is destroyed, with very little of value escaping the onslaught. And so it was. God destroyed the corrupt cities of the broad and open way. God remembered Abraham and sent Lot away from the midst of the demolition, the upending and overthrow of the cities which Lot had lived. 1929. Just 4 statements ago, Yahweh made the same point. So by repeating it, he wants to be certain that the observant don't miss the lessons which can be gleaned from this historical interaction between God and man. Just as Yahweh obliterated Sodom, eliminating its existence from the promised land, he will wipe out all forms of human, religious, political, societal, and conspiratorial, and even familial corruption from the earth before he returns. And And while that's obviously bad news for those who are beguiled by these perversions, the good news is he upholds his promises. He told Abraham that he would spare Lot's life before destroying the city in which he lived, and he did. He was good to his word. For the same reason, we should accept the conditions of the covenant, because we are assured of his benefits. God honors his promises. You'll also notice that Yah and his Malach messengers made no attempt to save anyone else. There were no public broadcasts, no newspaper articles, no sermons, or no impassioned orations. God honored the promises he made to Abraham as part of his covenant relationship and did nothing beyond that. So shouldn't we also expect that God will honor the covenant relationship conditions that he laid out to us through Abraham?
Absolutely.
And do nothing beyond that?
Yeah, probably not, because the numbers are small.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that the message here?
Yes.
Do you think that God's going to be different?
No.
Then, or now, than he was then? I don't think so. There were no exclusions for charitable behavior, no exclusions for nice thoughts, for long prayers, for a pure heart, for living a good life, for the young or for the old, for women or minorities, and especially not one for religious believers or compliant citizens. And since he has not and will not change his plans or approach, it means that he isn't going to solicit anyone apart from Yisrael and Yehudah before he returns to rid the world of all of those who are not part of his program. He reached out to save Lot because he was related to Abraham and because Abraham had asked, and it was important to Abraham. But he didn't reach out to anyone else. You know, this God wants to save the world? No. God wants you to go out and preach the gospel? No. You think that the flock could have stood on the stoop of Lot's home and told everybody in Sodom, this is what's going to happen? You think that God could send a messenger or two around to the other cities? But he didn't. I said, no, it's just over. I'm done with you. Goodbye. Good riddance. Saved one in a million, perhaps. And didn't really save him. Just got him out of town. And since he has not and will not change his plans or approach, it means that he's not going to solicit anyone apart from Yisrael and Yehudah before he returns to rid the world of all of those who are not part of his covenant program. Not going to be any exceptions. So we can grovel in the darkness of the dirt or soar in the radiance of the spiritual realm. And so Lot ascended out of Soar, trivial and immature, lowly and little, and settled in the higher elevation along with his two daughters because he was afraid. He was afraid to live in Zoar along with the lowly and little. And he crouched down, staying in this cave along with his two daughters. He now lived in fear of God. You know, I wrote something that I was just trying to edit because somebody said, you know, I don't understand what this means. I said, you know, it's really hard for God to come across as a loving father. I said, I don't care what you mean. Well, what if, JB, your dad was a billion times bigger than you are? And when he spoke, he was a billion times louder than you are. Are you going to snuggle up to him?
It'd be a little scary.
Oh, you know, if he coughed the wrong way, he's going to blow you off the planet. Right? If he kneeled down, around, he's going to squish you. If he tried to grab you, I mean, you're going to be a grease spot. And Yahweh is infinitely bigger than we are. It's really hard at the relative size capability for God to come off as an approachable, loving Father. And so, Lot, having seen his hometown obliterated, rather than trying to understand what had happened and why it happened, he just was scared to death. And it's one of the reasons that God doesn't speak directly to very many people. Because most people would be intimidated, scared to death. Lot was scared to death by what happened. And so what did he do? Did he try to understand? Did he try to reach out to Abraham? Did he said, can you teach me a lesson here? What did I miss? No, he hunkered down in a cave, scared to death. If you're going to be afraid of God, you aren't going to form a relationship with him. It's sad what happened to him. He had all the opportunity in the world. Now, one thing leads to another. That which was acceptable and considered correct in Sodom breeds misdirected and fractured families with stunted growth, leading to Zoar, remaining immature as a result of trivializing Yahweh's messages. Did the one called lowly and little for having fathered Christianity. Further, the girls grew up in Sodom, and they would give birth to Moab, to the modern incarnation of man, and to Ben-Ami, the offspring of our nation. And Lot, believing himself free and enlightened, was anything but from God's perspective, because he returned to the darkness of that horrific night in Sodom. These things are all interconnected. They're all part of the lesson. When we start valuing our opinions and believe that we're entitled to them, we distance ourselves from what Yahweh intended for us. The covenant family, by comparison, is guided by perfect parents, our Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother. As a result, the children of the covenant are lovingly led and intelligently instructed. Now, such is not the case with the family of man. We are still recording, guys, I would assume, but not broadcasting. And of course, this was a tough night for those that normally participate in the chat room, because the chat room was inoperative. But maybe it's good that under these circumstances that we don't go into what happened next. And we save that for another time. What do you guys think?
That's fine. Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds like a good plan to me.
When do you, a different subject, but when do you start your new job, JB?
Well, officially, it's actually in the same school district, so officially it's not till the 1st of July, but they pretty much already got me doing it now. So.
Okay, so it's in the same school district, so that's wonderful.
Yeah, basically they created a position that's over all of the other techs in the district, and that's me. So I'll be managing
other
techs and also serve as a tier 2 support for them. So.
Wow.
I'm excited.
Wow. Do you, you go to work in a similar place, or do you go to a county administration building?
The admin building for the district. So it's not the same office, but same. Yeah, it's a small town.
Okay, so it's still close by.
Yeah, oh yeah, actually probably a couple minutes closer than before.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy for you.
I was excited.
Wow. And Kirk, do you think you and Terry might have the opportunity to get some time off before too long and get everybody healthy?
I've got another week to teach, and then we have 2 weeks off. We have a little break coming up, so we'll be able to relax some. I have to tell you this. I didn't get a lot of time to do. I read what we were covering tonight a little bit, but I did have time the last couple of late nights. I read what you sent me, I think it's about 64 pages on Psalm 1, 2, and 3. And I'm telling you, that moved me more than anything I can recall. I mean, Nishikaka, Yada Yaw, and so forth. I mean, of course, they're on a plane different. But this was just, reason it struck me is interesting, I think, because the first thing I thought of as I was reading it, the other day I was between two of my students working with them and on their easels, and we were talking about, they know that I study this. And one of them even, I gave Intro to God, and she felt it was too difficult for her to get involved with, so whatever. But they still, they're just wonderful people, both of them. And I'm thinking, this has got to touch them so much more than even all the other stuff. I mean, this is just all money to them. And I was just
these first five, and I think the first three are in chapter one of volume three.
Uh-huh.
And I was moved to goosebumps. I mean, all the way through. It is. What Dode has to say is just. I can say for absolute certainty.
Uh-huh.
We are on the right path, paying attention to what Dode has written and how God's using him.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, Kirk. I began to think after reading and translating the first three, Mizmor, now the next two beyond that. And now I'm dealing with Mizmor 103. I jumped before doing 6 and 7. I'm doing 103. And I just came to realize, you know, there's not a single prophecy that names Yosha. He's not named in a single prophecy.
Really?
And Dode is named in hundreds upon hundreds. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it is that we have more words from Dode and know more about him and what he said than anyone else? And we don't have a single word from Yosha that is reliably recorded in the language he spoke it.
That was his job. I mean, he's very selective on this person is going to do that and this person is going
that's
to
right.
do that. And
more important, beyond the fact that Moshe had a job, Dode had a job, and Yosha had a job, all essential jobs. You know, all of them absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't open the door.
There's a reason that we don't hear. We don't have a single word Yosha said in the language that he spoke it reliably maintained. There's a reason that there's not a single prophecy that actually calls out Yosha by name. There's a reason. And the reason is that that's God's nature. To the extent that Yosha in the last 3 years when the Spirit came upon him was the diminished manifestation of Yahweh. Yahweh is doing what he said he would do. He's told us what he's going to do, why it's important, how he's going to do it, why he's doing it. But it's not in his nature to call attention to him. He's not going to say, look at me, how wonderful I am. I'm enduring this for you. It's not his nature.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing that he said that isn't available in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and beautifully maintained. You know, it's interesting that when Yosha is at the single most important moment of his life, he came to fulfill Pesach. And at the moment that he is fulfilling Pesach as the Passover lamb, who does he quote?
Dode.
Yep. And it couldn't be more obvious. Dode's the Son of God.
Uh-huh.
I know that really sounds strange to most people's ears, but that's exactly what Yahweh tells us over and over again. Dode is my son. I am his father. We don't have any indication that Yosha was Mashiach, anointed, the word that is transliterated Messiah. There's only two places where it's not a title, but actually one place. It's in Daniel guess, where it it's used as an adjective to modify a messenger that's been called out and prepared to do a job. But there, it's an adjective, it's not a title. The only two times it's even hinted at that that you know he's going to perform this role. But Yahweh routinely calls Dod his Mashiach, which is where we get the word Messiah.
Yeah, this
there's this thought that how in the world can Yahweh give Yosha, you know, a kingdom when he promised it to Dod?
That's a good point, of course.
Kind of cuts you off.
Yeah. You know, the difference is that Dod is a guy, one of us, that figured it out and could convey the message as one of us brilliantly. In other words, there is nothing that Yahweh is more excited about, more proud of, more celebratory of, wants us to know, than, yeah, one of us did figure it out, so all of us can figure it out. Well, you know, when you're a father, JB, you've done a lot of things. Are you more excited when you do something or when your daughter does something?
Oh, when she does, by far.
By far, right? So, do you think that Yahweh is more excited that he, in a diminished manifestation of himself, accomplished something? Or that his son was able to figure it out?
No question.
No question. And it's so perfect. In so many ways, you know, I've been accused of having a bromance with Dod, and by the way, it's over. There are so many things that dude did that I don't like, that really irk me. You know, the way he dealt with his daughter's rape, the way he dealt with the revolt of his thirdborn. A lot of things. The way he of course, got a man killed because, you know, seven wives and or six wives at the time, and 10 concubines weren't enough. The way that he chose when God gave him three options, he chose very poorly. He made some decisions that I just really don't like, really uncomfortable with, bother me a lot. But I'm going to tell you, there's never been a wiser man. There's never been a more brilliant communicator among men. He is, he's the guy that provides the right example. And by being less than ideal as a father, as a husband, what he does is tell us it's okay. That God can love us in spite of the fact of our flaws, so long as we're right about what's important. And so, the badder Dod is, the better it is for us. The Torah was designed to perfect the imperfect.
Yeah.
And so, we don't have to be embarrassed. Dod was looked at as being perfect in Yahweh's eyes, because that's the nature of his garment of light. It covers all darkness, obliterates darkness, removes it. So all Yahweh ever saw was his son.
Perfection.
Yeah, saying and doing marvelous things.
That's so well.
And so it is. It's this whole insight as to why it's not about the Yosha, but it's about Dod, has been such an eye-opener. But it's the nature of the covenant. Yahweh's not celebrating a relationship with himself, but with his sons and daughters, the children. He conceived exactly. That's the intent. That's why he did what he did.
Perfect sense.
That's why he said what he said. That's why he created the universe. And Dod is the perfect example of it. And Dod's real. He's got all the emotions and the flaws and the kind of the sometimes you just stumble all over yourself stuff that he's real.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, and such a source of brilliant sayings and insights, and the way that Yahweh uses him. And boy, are we ever right on the importance of doubt. And Yahweh makes it clear. It's it over and over again. And one of the things that's so interesting is that every time there's one of these prophecies that Christians say, "Yep, that's about Jesus." If you just read it in context, you'd say, "No, it does." In fact, it can't be Jesus for this, and this reason. But it is Dode for all of those reasons. When the world's largest religion is celebrating the wrong person. And it ought to be, they ought to know better, because he even said, the Father is greater than I, which means he's diminished. So why would you celebrate worship? Yeah, name a religion off the diminished manifestation. When he said, no, pay attention to the Father. So it's it is a just this marvelous experience seeing it all laid out for us, and how important this is, and the thing that is really really comforting about this is that for the last 2,000 years, the world's most deadly conspiracy has been blame the Jews. And the guy that started the Blame the Jews conspiracy was Paul. Now, the author of 14 letters and the inspiration behind half the Christian New Testament. He started the Blame the Jews game. And, of course, they were the enemies of Christianity in Paul's letters. And they're accused of killing the Christian God. If they killed the Christian God, maybe you ought to be worshiping them rather than the Christian God, because
they're pretty
capable of killing him. Yeah. But it's the single most deadly and most ungodly conspiracy in the world. And all of these people that have this twisted hatred of Jews, not recognizing that their Jesus was Jewish, and that everybody that wrote on his behalf was Jewish, and that he spoke Hebrew, and he lived in Judea, they parade their dead God around on a stick. And I want to tell you, there isn't one chance in a billion that that's going to appeal to the chosen people. Yeah, I realize there's some 10,000 Jews for Jesus. They've done is done the same thing the Jews have done over the millennia. That's why there's God's calling Yehudim from all three Babylons. Because in geographic Babylon, to survive, they converted to Islam. And in religious Babylon, they converted to Roman Catholicism. And in political Babylon, you know, they live as secular humanists in the United States. And there is no chance that those people, God's people, are going to respond to dead God on a stick. They're not going to respond to this corrupted, perverse image of Dionysus that they know is wrong, that is misnamed, mischaracterized, and has been the source of their torment and death and torture for 2,000 years. But what if the one calling them home, the Messiah they need to accept, their king, the Son of God, is the man that God revealed more through than anyone else, that was the one that existed exactly halfway through the human experience? What if God is calling them to be part of Dode's family, that the Yehudim of Yehud of all Yehudim is the one they need to accept, the one they need to listen to, the one that's calling them home. Changes everything, doesn't it?
Wow, does it?
And that's the way it is. It's not a what if. The only surprising thing in the whole shebang is that God couldn't find a single Yisraelite, not a single Yehud, to tell Dode's story. That's the only surprising part of the whole thing.
Well, yeah. I'm glad I'm here with you guys.
Yeah, it's interesting that when you and I'll send you my translation if you want to read it, or if you'd prefer
Absolutely.
Just to go and translate Shlomo's dedication
I'll
speech on your own. But it's interesting that that this Nakri, this foreigner, that the idea was that out of the atmosphere, the whole world simultaneously with Yisrael would come to know Yahweh's name and what he was asking and offering, all simultaneously.
Wow.
So there is a specific reference to the whole world in addition to Yisrael having this opportunity. So that's why I think about half of those who have joined the covenant are, have no ethnicity ties, no ethnic ties to Yisrael, but are grafted in, have chosen to be part of what it means to be Yisrael. Anyway, we're going to have some fun. It's this we've
I'm
only.
I'm surprised you've been able to retain, stop from going there. I mean,
I know I have no discipline,
first.
As you know. When I
yeah.
I have.
Okay,
when you
home,
get going on something, you kind of.
Yeah, I get enthused. It's exciting for me. But you know,
exciting.
you've now read. You know, I hinted at the chapter that's now called the Second Coming, and I've sent it to you. And I remember I made a big deal of it. I said, you know, there's something really special in that chapter, and there is, isn't there?
Yes.
I wasn't kidding. And the third chapter, the second chapter of volume 3. It leaves the first one in the dust.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it does.
whenever you can. I love to read.
Yeah, so it's really amazing. The only reason I wouldn't send it to you right now is I don't know if you want to look at Shlomo's speech. You cannot read. You're not going to find it in your NIV. I read the NIV and the New American Standard. Oh my goodness, did they get the words twisted? Because they can't fathom what Solomon said. I couldn't. First time I read it, I was just no. It can't be.
Well, I said you couldn't get anybody. The Christians will throw rocks at us.
Oh, of course. And good they do. But wait till you tackle it. It's because interesting. I've never been a fan, as you know, of Solomon. But Solomon is a kind of a microcosm, a diminished version of his father. Dode, for the first probably 50 of his 70 years, was the most extraordinary individual the planet's ever known. And, you know, maybe he had a little too much wine, a little too much of the girls, a little too much of war, a little too much of the fancy living. And, his last 20 years weren't so good. Solomo is similar, just a faster rise and fall. You know, his father passes away, and he inherits all that that his father had collected to build the temple. He's wealth because Yah made a deal with him. Wealth just falls into his lap, and he starts off doing what he was tasked to do, building the house. And his speech is magnificent. some really stupid stuff, and almost everything he wrote was foolish. So he too had he wasn't consistent through his life. But the speech he gave on the dedication of the Yahweh's house, it's one to remember.
Where is that?
I'm gonna have to look into that.
Yep. It's kind of really with your eyes and everything and your time. It's a question: do you want to do it completely on your own, or would your preference be that I send you the translation of it and you verify it to determine whether or not you think it's
accurate? Well, I like to do my thing and then see what you came up with. So even if you send it, I'll still do the first thing first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me read it
and translate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me look it up here for you.
First Kings 8, and I want to say verse 12 was when I looked it up earlier.
Okay, one thing you may want to look up is Yahshua 53:1.
53:1, okay, got it.
Yahshua 53:1. And then 2 Chronicles 6, 32 and 33. Maybe it's even 31, 32, and 33, but
okay.
Second Chronicles right around the 30th verse.
Okay.
Got it.
Okay.
But
so we'll exchange notes and take a stab at it at doing it on your own, and then we'll compare notes as to what you think.
Okay, we'll do.
Sounds good.
Congratulations again, JB. That's wonderful.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. You guys get well. Good night.
All righty, gentlemen.
Good night.
Yeah.
I'll see y'all next week. Shalom, shalom. Good night.
Okay, shalom.
Shalom.